7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. States everywhere, from Bhutan to Honduras, are trying to build shiny new cities. But how many are just the experiments of vainglorious billionaires? Could any of these planned developments actually rise above existing ones? And our correspondent takes us to the archive of retail star Marks & Spencer. It turns out that knickers and cardigans can reveal quite a lot about Britain's social history and even help solve crimes. First up, though. It has been called one of the biggest financial frauds in American history. In November last year, a jury took just 4 hours to convict Sam Bankman-Fried, the former boss of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, on 7 complicated charges.
Sam Bankman-Fried has been found guilty of the charges. There were 7 counts, including wire fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, as well as conspiracy to commit money laundering and a number of others.
Following FTX's collapse, $8 billion of its customers' money was unaccounted for. And today, in a New York federal court, Mr. Bankman-Fried, also known as SBF, is due to be sentenced. He maintains that he did nothing wrong, blaming accounting mistakes for the missing money. But the jail time facing the 32-year-old former king of crypto could be harsh.
The sentencing that is due today essentially marks the completion of the downfall of Sam Bankman-Fried, excluding any appeals that he might file.
Alice Forward is our Wall Street correspondent and the co-host of Money Talks, our podcast on business and finance.
This is essentially the last step in his conviction. Before the collapse of his empire, he was fabulously wealthy. He was the leading whiz kid of the crypto industry. He was hobnobbing with politicians in the White House and celebrities and lived this extremely glamorous life. Today, he could face as much as 110 years in prison. Now, his own lawyer has described this possibility as grotesque, and it's not the sentence that prosecutors are seeking. They've asked for between 40 and 50 years. Meanwhile, in their defense filings, Sam Bankman-Fried's lawyers have argued for just 6.
Okay, before we get on to the sentencing, what exactly was the fraud and conspiracy that Sam Bankman-Fried was found guilty of?
So Sam Bankman-Fried ran a cryptocurrency exchange called FTX. Customers would deposit money, either dollars or cryptocurrency, in that exchange, and they could then buy and sell crypto as they pleased. The fraudulent part of this is that FTX loaned, at various points in its life, basically all of the customer money that had been deposited with it to a sister company, which was this sort of trading firm or hedge fund Sam Bankman-Fried had also founded called Alameda Research. And through Alameda Research, Sam Bankman-Fried had made a lot of investments. He'd sort of spent money on property. He'd loaned money to employees of FTX. But the precipitating event for the downfall of FTX was the revelation by CoinDesk of a balance sheet from Alameda, and it revealed that essentially all of Alameda's value was measured in tokens that had been issued or created by Sam Bankman-Fried. It sort of had very, very few hard assets. And there had long been question marks about the relationship between FTX and Alameda, and seeing this balance sheet, seeing that it really didn't seem to have much to show for itself, customers began to lose confidence in FTX. They started withdrawing their funds, and eventually FTX suspended withdrawals. It could no longer pay out people who were sort of coming to get their money back. And, you know, a few days later, it filed for bankruptcy with roughly $8 billion of customer money missing. When it went to trial, three of his former colleagues took the stand against him, admitted fraud, sounded very remorseful and at times distraught by the actions that they had played a role in, and, you know, said that he had directed them to do everything that had occurred.
Oh, they really threw him under the bus. So does that mean that SBF is likely to receive a sentence closer to the maximum 100-ish years than six?
There are some things that might make you think that he would get a long sentence. One is that he really didn't endear himself at all to the judge. He repeatedly violated the rules of his release from prison in the run-up to the trial. So he used a VPN while he was on house arrest to sort of contact witnesses, lawyers doing the bankruptcy proceedings. He said a lot of things in public that were then revealed in the trial not to be truthful. He showed the private diaries of his ex-girlfriend, Caroline Ellison, who was a witness testifying against him and who ran Alameda, to the New York Times, and they published excerpts from them. So the worst case scenario is that the judge sort of looks at all of this behavior and wants to sort of give him quite a long sentence. The counterargument to that, which his lawyers have put forward, is that of the money that was lost when FTX declared bankruptcy in November, the efforts to recoup that actually are doing pretty well. They seem to be arguing that there will be a full repayment of the money that was lost when FTX went bankrupt, potentially plus interest. And so the total harm that has been done to people from his crimes is actually much smaller than you might have thought, and smaller than in other fraud cases of similar magnitude. They also point to other factors, like that he's already served some time and he suffers from autism and attention deficit disorder and other conditions that make serving time particularly difficult for him. People seem to think that he will end up being given a sentence of between 20 and 25, maybe 30 years. That's the range that lawyers that I've spoken to or people who've commented publicly on the case seem to think that he will get.
Now, you mentioned that some of customers' money has been recouped. How much are we talking here?
As of last August, which was the last time we got an update from the bankruptcy team, FTX had recovered about $7.8 billion in cash and liquid crypto assets. And that does seem to be roughly the size of the hole that was left in the balance sheet when the company failed. Now, this has partly been made possible by just finding more assets. There were lots of crypto accounts or bank accounts that the company had lost track of that have turned out to have assets in them. But actually, what's sort of driven the sort of seemingly high recovery rate is that a lot of the assets that they held have actually done very well since November 2022. So if you think about crypto, that $8 billion in November of 2022, that was when Bitcoin was worth maybe a sixth of its current value. And creditors in FTX, those who had bought crypto, bought Bitcoin on the platform, will be paid back a dollar amount. So because crypto's gone up so much, that is inflating the dollar value of the crypto that was left. So it does look as though most of the money is going to be recouped. The problem is that, you know, a lot of customers think about their loss in terms of sort of crypto, not in terms of the dollar amount in November of 2022. And so some customers, even though in theory they're getting all of their money back as of the dollar value in November 2022, they feel like they are being shortchanged here.
Because now crypto is performing well. I mean, it sounds like none of this has impacted confidence in crypto markets.
It certainly did in the short term. So when FTX collapsed, the price of crypto fell very sharply. And then about a year after FTX failed, you also saw a huge blow to FTX rival Binance, which was fined by the US government for its involvement in money laundering and terrorist financing. The CEO of Binance, Changpeng Zhao, was forced to step down. The firm is now being monitored very closely. So you essentially had these two biggest exchanges either failing or facing huge challenges in relatively quick succession. That said, there are a lot of reasons why crypto might be climbing again now. One is just interest rates tend to sort of move inversely with those, and people think that interest rates have peaked. The other is that actually a lot of this close scrutiny of crypto and regulators and legal authorities getting involved, there is an argument that that's washed out many of the problems in crypto, and the firms that are left are better regulated and more compliant in general. There have actually been some sort of positive regulatory developments in crypto as well, which might make it sort of easier for more people to buy into it. So the SEC recently approved the creation of exchange-traded funds that could hold Bitcoin. And there have been huge inflows into these funds since January when they were created. And that seems to have coincided with its sort of most recent rise. So although the failure of FTX was a sort of huge blow for crypto, it might ultimately be good news for the industry that's left behind.
Alice, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ari. Always a pleasure to be here.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
All around the world, cities are rising up.
Egypt is preparing to spend billions, doubling the size of its lavish new capital, the new desert city.
Get ready for Tolosa, a $400 billion proposed smart city in the United States.
Saudi Arabia's $500 billion mega project, NEOM, which is being built from the ground up, is tapping Asian expertise.
We're building more cities than at any time in the post-war period. 91 of them have been announced in the past decade, with 15 in the past year alone. Bhutan just announced one new city, Iraq has started building five, and Donald Trump says he wants to build 10 so-called freedom cities. In the early stages, projects have attracted their fair share of criticism. But the sheer number and diversity of these projects suggests that at least some will take off.
On the face of it, building new cities should be a great thing.
Corbin Duncan writes about business and finance for The Economist.
Some economists think that cities are mankind's greatest invention. When they work well, they make us happier, healthier, richer, greener. And there are some really pressing issues with our existing urban areas that mean that building new cities really makes sense. But despite all this, today's city builders face a pretty cold reception.
Corbin, what are the critics saying?
All right, as we know, governments around the world today love industrial policy. And so some critics think that this is just another wasteful attempt at reshaping economies using government funds. Others see these as quixotic projects by vainglorious billionaires who are looking for a legacy project. But these critics often overlook the diversity of the cities under construction today. So they tend to focus on flashy projects like Saudi Arabia's NEOM, where the government is trying to create this 170-kilometer-long building that they think will wean themselves off of oil dollars. They're trying to attract new industries like tourism, manufacturing, and financial services. Another example might be El Salvador's plans to sell bonds that pay out in Bitcoin in order to fund what they call a cryptocurrency city. But there are also lots of less flashy projects. And to this end, I spoke to Stephen Jennings, who's a former private equity boss turned developer.
But the more time and the more deals and the more people we met, the more I became interested in how dysfunctional the cities were and on the scarcity of high-quality, large-scale urban infrastructure.
In Tatu City, outside of Nairobi in Kenya, he's trying to create infrastructure and institutions that would make a place safe for both capital and people.
So things like litter and traffic controls are...
He's focusing on the more boring stuff.
Okay, you've talked so far about building new cities, but how about improving our existing ones? Wouldn't it be better to do that?
Yeah, Ore, I've spoken to lots of architects and developers, and all of them are very keen to insist that they are not giving up on our existing cities. But from Nairobi to San Francisco, they face a lot of the same challenges. Those are planning regimes, infrastructure, and housing shortages, which aren't keeping pace with growing urban populations. Retrofitting existing urban infrastructure can be really slow, expensive, and it's a very risk-averse process. And by building new cities, there's more opportunity for experimentation. In some cases, people are completely rethinking how society operates within those cities.
Interesting. Who's doing that?
One of the more experimental projects is Tolosa City, which should be built somewhere in the deserts of Western North America. The billionaire behind that project, Mark Law, claims to want to do away with private ownership of land. Instead, he wants to hold land in a communal trust and then use the funds from leasing that land out to pay for public services within the city. Some of these cities really double as social experiments, and the ideas range from really sensible to quite outlandish.
And as you say, some of these really are experiments. How many of these new cities do you think will actually prosper?
City building is really hard, and we are very much out of practice. There are lots of challenges. The upfront costs can be staggering, and that involves years of negative cash flow. And over that time, money and enthusiasm for the project can run out. For example, work on Egypt's $60 billion capital city has really slowed as that country's economy falters. In Malaysia, Forest City, which was being built by a Chinese property developer, is complete, but the developer has now gone into default, and the city remains mostly empty. But history points to some examples that have succeeded. So we're thinking about Milton Keynes outside of London, Reston outside of Washington, D.C., Chandigarh in India, and Brasilia in Brazil. They all have pretty modest growth, but it's consistent and people are voting with their feet. More people want to live there. It's true that these new cities are unlikely to become the world-leading cities that we know, like London and Singapore, but it's worth remembering that some greenfield cities have succeeded, and they can go on to become growing, sustainable, mid-tier cities. As Stephen Jennings said, the crucial thing is getting the boring stuff right, roads, sewerage, and the like, getting that infrastructure in place so that people actually want to move there. One of the people I interviewed for this story said that in order for a city to be mixed use, mixed income, it needs to be all use, all income. And that means that you need to have the infrastructure in place for people to want to move to that new city. So even though some of these cities might fail, and even if we view all of these new cities as experiments, all of them are learning something new about mankind's greatest invention. And we should applaud them for that.
Corbin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ori.
Consider the corpse, or to be more precise, consider its pants.
Catherine Nixie is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
When the body was pulled from the North Sea in 1994, almost all clues to its identity had gone. One or two things were still obvious. It was clear that the man had been tall, he was 6'5", that he had been well-dressed, he had fancy loafers on, and that whatever had led to him bobbing around in the North Sea hadn't been very nice. He had a head injury. But dating his death was clearly going to be hard. Except for one thing, his underwear. Because in his pants was a small white label. It stated that they were medium, that they were 100% cotton, and best of all, that they were made by St. Michael. Suddenly there was hope. This was not just a corpse. This was an M&S corpse. This matters because M&S, or Marks & Spencer's, is a British retailer with a rich history, and that history is contained in its own archive. Just outside the city centre in Leeds are 72,000 items, 3,300 of them are clothes. On rails and on shelves, in ghostly white suit covers, and in boxes filled with tissue paper, lie a nation's cast-offs. There are jumpers and cardigans, suits and romper suits, leggings and jeggings, bed jackets and bras. And above all, because this is not just an archive, this is an M&S archive, there are pants. There are tiny pants and startlingly enormous pants. There are silky pants and bafflingly woolly pants. There are lacy pants, racy pants, and supremely sensible pants. I went to look at some of these pants and some of the other clothes that they held there with the archivist Katie Cameron.
These are 1950s watches.
They're amazing. Sort of enormous, actually.
I love them.
They're incredibly rich and big.
I think they'll be nylon. In
the
some of the 1920 stuff, all of it. We're talking about fleecy knickers, so they would have been really, you know, toasty.
Oh, God, that's a warm pair of pants, isn't it?
Yeah, with the added synthetic element as well.
So toasty is the word that you're looking for in your knickers early on, is it?
Pants might seem trivial. They are not. Occasionally, just occasionally, they're important to police who are looking to solve crimes. So the archive's detailed records and M&S's date-stamped labels can help to date corpses. Here is a top tip for murderers. Cut the labels off your corpse. Pants are also extremely important to M&S. The shop sells food and home accessories as well, but it really is known for its underwear. Around one in every four pairs of pants sold in Britain today is bought there. So for listeners in Britain, there is a good chance that you're sitting on a bottom that has been wrapped in M&S cotton. And though they might not seem it, pants are also important to British history, because clothes and how well they wear, and above all, how well they wash, matter fundamentally to women. And M&S helped to improve both.
I think it might be.
One of the things you notice when you go around the archive is how much of it is synthetic materials. There is rail after rail of fabrics such as nylon and rayon and terraline and crimpoline. These sound comic to modern ears. But in fact, they were of serious importance in easing the daily burden of the British housewife. People write a lot about labour-saving devices, but what people often forget is that you need labour-saving materials, which are often sturdy synthetic ones, to go in them. And these fabrics, these rayons and terralines and so on, freed women up, as one expert told me. Because long before women were liberated by burning their bras, they were liberated by being able to pop them in the twin tub and let them drip dry without ironing. I actually found going to the archives in Leeds an oddly moving experience. One of those things that captures women's history, and a lot of women's history, is in fact just washing. At first sight, it feels like any other archive, but if you open its boxes, another world immediately appears. In one box, there's a beautiful 1940s pink silken bra, and its cups are puffed up with tissue paper as if almost by a ghostly bosom. On a nearby rail, there are dressing gowns. One of them's post-war and woolly, one is diaphanous and 1970s. One has the kind of paisley-ish pattern that a stern 1950s father might have worn. Each of them is almost unbearably evocative of its era. Proust might have had his Madeleines, but Britons have M&S crimpoline cardigans.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show. You can always email us at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.